Welcome to the History of European Theatre podcast, and thanks for joining me on this journey through millennia of theatrical history. Episode 115, Dionysus and Xanthias, the first double act. Maybe I should have numbered this episode 15A because, as a little extra before we get into the Shakespeare timeline that I promised you last time, I'm heading back into ancient Greek theatre to have a look at The Frogs by Aristophanes. I'm prompted to do this because recently I saw a production of The Frogs, which was presented by the physical comedy troupe Spy Monkey. More of them later, but just to say for the moment that the play was performed as a three-hander and was heavily adapted, as they put it, with massive apologies to Aristophanes. Actually, I don't think they had too much to apologise for. When I wrote the episode on Aristophanes way back in season one, and can you believe it, that's 3.5 years ago, I wrote about his life and three of his plays, The Clouds, The Wasps, and of course, Lysistrata. I don't remember why I decided not to cover The Frogs at the time. Probably I thought that three plays as a sample of the work was enough. But it does seem to be a particularly strange decision, as I can remember being intrigued by the edition of the play that sat in a bookshelf in my childhood home. This was the Gilbert Murray verse translation, a volume with a striking green cover and a white line drawing of two rather sullen-looking frogs sitting in the rushes. On the bookshelf, it was paired with The Birds, in a similar cover, another Aristophanes play I didn't cover as I hit the later episodes in season one. So seeing the play now seemed like all the excuse I needed to go back to it. As it's been a while, let me give you a quick recap on Aristophanes and his work. In fact, the biography of Aristophanes will be very quick, as we know virtually nothing about his life. Much of what we do think we know comes from the self-referencing passages in his plays. We can say that he was born about 446 BCE and died about 386 BCE. We don't know anything about his parentage, except that his father was called Philippus and the family resided in an area in the heart of Athens, which included the site of the Acropolis. He wrote plays in a genre that was already well established by the time The Frogs was first performed. In fact, he came towards the end of the period that produced what we now call old comedy. It was only about 50 years after his death that the nature of comedy changed with a generational change in tastes and became the now virtually unknown, apart from fragments, middle comedy. Aristophanes and his predecessors wrote comic satire that was concerned with the actions of the gods on the fate of man and with how man failed to govern himself. Old comedy always took a critical stance and lacked the focus on the domestic that the later middle and the then new comedy presented, the latter being represented by the surviving works of Menander. Old comedy is first identified about 500 BCE and survived for about 150 years. The earliest references to comic plays are to a poet, Caesarion of Megaris, who's credited with taking local rustic comedy, which we assume included jesting, singing, dancing, and comic storytelling, and turning it into a form that somewhat followed the existing theatrical traditions of tragedy, formalising action and introducing the use of the chorus into comic plays. Only slightly later, we know of Epicramus of Kos. Again, only fragments of his work survive, but he's mentioned by Aristotle in the Poetics as the inventor of comic plots, and by Plato and Socrates and many others. Socrates styled Epicramus as the king of comedy, and in so doing, he put him alongside Homer, who he called the king of tragedy. The fragments we have suggest he wrote between 30 and 50 comedies, which covered both comic takes on heroic figures and comedy based around the habits and beliefs of rural societies. Plato also wrote comedy, although none survive, and some of the ancient commentary suggests that in some cases he relied heavily on the earlier works by Epicramus. The first recorded recipients of laurels at the Dionysia Festival for comedy are Chionides and Magnus in 487 BCE and 472 BCE respectively, but little else is known about these poets or their works. A third great of the old comedy genre was Eupolis. Sources differ on the exact dates, but his first play is recorded as being produced in about 430 BCE, so very contemporary with the emergence of Aristophanes. It's likely that his first productions were at the Linnea Festival, where it seems the entry criteria allowed novice playwrights to hone their craft before granting entry to the Dionysia, which was always the premier competition. 11 of 40 known plays that Aristophanes is credited with survive in complete or almost complete forms, and they are the only complete examples that we have of this old comedy genre. It seems that he started writing and wanting to produce plays at a very young age, but he was too young to be allowed to produce at a festival, so an arrangement was made for the plays to be directed and produced by a friend or colleague called Callistratus. Similar arrangements were also made for his next two plays, with either Callistratus or another dramatist called Philonides directing. It was an arrangement that was also repeated with some of the later plays. We know it was the norm for playwrights to produce and direct their own plays, and sometimes perform in them, so this does seem to be a particular preference of Aristophanes, and a conscious decision to have an alternative director. However, it does add a complication when we're looking for biographical details. Anything that we take from the plays that we know were directed by others could refer to them and not to Aristophanes at all. Following The Banqueters, that first play, and a couple of other very early plays, three victories at the Linnea Festival are recorded, and the Frogs had a unique distinction of being repeated at a later festival. Usually plays were only performed for the competition and not repeated. His oldest son, Araros, was also a comic poet and probably involved with the production of his father's plays, particularly two that were produced posthumously. Two other sons were possibly also playwrights and were victorious at later Linnea festivals. The Frogs was presented at the Linnea in 405 BCE, and significantly it was produced within a year of the death of Euripides, and when Athens was still at a low point militarily. Deep in the Peloponnesian War, Athenian forces had unexpectedly won the Battle of Arginusae, but the generals who gained that victory had then been tried and executed for failing to rescue sailors from the water in the aftermath of the battle and follow up the victory properly. Generous peace terms from Sparta had been rejected, and the city faced shortages of manpower both in the city and in the army. As the play was performed, Athenians probably didn't realise that within a year the city would be under siege and starvation would be setting in. But the barbed comments about the failings of soldiers and the bad leadership of the political classes must have left some feeling very uncomfortable as they watched the play. Its overarching theme is a discussion about what values are most likely to save the city, and the sense that the death of Euripides, and to an extent that of Sophocles too, marked the end of the golden age of Athens, even though that had not quite happened yet. The play opens with the god Dionysus travelling with his slave Xanthias, who is riding on a donkey. They are on their way to visit Heracles, and as they travel, they argue about what kind of jokes are acceptable to be voiced. When they reach Heracles, they tell him that they are on the way to Hades to rescue the playwright Euripides from death. As the two gods talk about the tragedies that they have seen, Xanthias unloads the baggage, complaining about his lot in life. Dionysus knows that Heracles has visited Hades and stole the beast that guards the gates, Cerberus. Heracles suggests several ways that Dionysus could kill himself as the easiest way to get to Hades, but Dionysus is only interested in the easiest way to get there without such a dramatic action. He says, "Forget my courage. Show me the highway, the shortest one there is, that takes me directly down to Hades." Heracles smirks at the idea of the courage of Dionysus, but he relents and eventually describes a route that will take him there without killing himself. He describes how, when they arrive at a river of mud and excrement in which people who have done terrible things are submerged, they will hear pipes and see a beautiful light and a procession of the initiates of the Eleusinian mysteries, who will tell them everything that they need to know. The journey continues, with Xanthias suggesting that they find a dead person to carry the baggage. But when they do, Dionysus refuses to pay the fee he demands. They trudge on, and eventually arrive at the gates of Hades, where Charon the ferryman meets them. He refuses to take Xanthias, as he didn't fight at the Battle of Arginusae. Dionysus gets into the boat while instructing Xanthias to walk the long way around the lake, Then, much to his consternation, Charon hands him the oar, expecting him to row. As they travel across the lake, a chorus of frogs sing, or rather croak, their chant, which irritates Dionysus, as it is too fast for his rowing speed. He pleads with them to stop, finding their croaky chorus too grating. But they reply, Arno, loud and louder our chant must flow. Sing if ever ye sang of yore, when in sunny and glorious days, through the rushes and marsh flags springing, on we swept, in the joys of singing myriad diving roundelays. Or when fleeing the storm, we went down to the depths, and our choral song wildly raised on a loud and long bubble-bursting accompaniment. The noise spurs Dionysus to row hard, and they soon arrive at the lake shore. Charon announces their arrival at the far shore of the lake, and Dionysus is reunited with Xanthias. They have arrived at the river of mud and excrement. Peering into the darkness of Hades, Xanthias is convinced that he sees changing shapes in the gloom, which leads to Dionysus becoming afraid that they are about to encounter Empusa, the shape-shifting demon. As Dionysus cowers behind his slave, he is convinced that he sees the shapeshifter changing before his eyes, becoming various beasts and then into a woman. But we are left wondering if this is in fact just a joke by Xanthias, happy to get one over on his master. As the spectre apparently vanishes, they hear charming flute music and the chorus enter, performing as the initiates of the Eleusinian mysteries. As the chorus invoke their divine mysteries, Dionysus tells Xanthias they should keep entirely quiet and find out more. The chorus sings and dances a couple of verses, praying for a light to guide them on their way in their dance of rejuvenation. The chorus leader comes forward, chanting a proclamation, instructing wrongdoers and outsiders to depart. Dionysus and Xanthias join in, dancing and exchanging sung verses with the chorus, whose song praises Athena as protector of Athens and pokes fun at some of the current city leaders. When Dionysus requests directions to the palace in Hades, where Pluto and Persephone reside, the chorus point out that it is already close by. As the chorus exit, Dionysus knocks on the door, claiming to be Heracles. Fooled by his disguise, the doorkeeper assaults Dionysus as Heracles, still angry that he stole Cerberus. Terrified, Dionysus instructs Xanthias to change places with him. They swap the disguise. A slave comes out and, fooled by the disguise, embraces Xanthias as Heracles, telling him that the goddess has prepared a feast and dancing virgins for him. Dionysus quickly demands the cloak of Heracles back from Xanthias. The chorus compare Dionysus to politicians who switch sides for little reason. An innkeeper enters and, recognising Heracles, accuses the disguised Dionysus of not paying a bill for food and drink at the time of his last visit. In the face of threatened violence, Dionysus and Xanthias once again switch the disguise. When the doorkeeper returns with assistance to punish Heracles, Xanthias offers Dionysus as his slave to be punished in his place. But as the man set on Dionysus, he reveals the nature of the disguise that they have both been sharing. Both men are whipped and taken into Hades for judgment, where Xanthias hears Aeschylus and Euripides arguing. A slave explains that since arriving in Hades, Euripides has challenged Aeschylus for his position as the greatest tragedian, and a contest is about to be staged to decide the matter. A pair of scales will be used to weigh their words, with the weightier of the two winning. A shocked Xanthias asks who could possibly be qualified to preside over such a contest, only to discover that Dionysus has already been chosen by Pluto to do exactly that. The chorus introduce the contest, and Euripides and Aeschylus enter mid-argument. After an exchange of insults, the two poets are encouraged to offer prayers to the gods, before the chorus leader extols them to offer up samples of their best work and to be full of wit, straight to the point, and avoid repeating clichés. Euripides accuses Aeschylus of using too many words that people don't understand, and too many pauses, claiming he simplified tragedy, making it democratic and accessible. Aeschylus defends his work by claiming that it inspired bravery in those who were about to go to war and showed citizens the way to live a good life. The arguments continue, with the chorus encouraging the poets to fight hard. They quote their own work and then each other's, with Dionysus torn between which is best. The poets double down on their efforts with critical comments about each other's work and insults. Euripides shows that he can condense all of Aeschylus's songs into one, and Aeschylus mocks how Euripides combined low and highbrow materials. They speak their words into the scales, and over three comparisons, Aeschylus wins every time, because his words deal with weightier matters. As Aeschylus gloats over his win, Dionysus still cannot formally pick a winner, as both men are his friend. Eventually, he awards the win to Aeschylus, and they all depart for a banquet before Dionysus, Xanthias, and Aeschylus will all be allowed to depart for the world of the living. Pluto sends Aeschylus off with his good wishes, confident that he can save Athens by educating the civic leaders into better policies, as he puts it, "So now farewell, Aeschylus, go. Save our city with your noble thought and educate our fools." Even stripped down to the bare plot, I think you can see that there is much to enjoy in The Frogs. Like the other surviving plays by Aristophanes, it is a very fantastical piece, but rooted in very serious contemporary concerns. Many of those are rather lost on us now, but for his Athenian audience, the references to politicians who changed their minds seemingly for their own benefits, or to citizens who had not pulled their weight during the Peloponnesian War, or indeed to playwrights who seemed too clever by half, or too concerned with salacious stories, must have been seen as hard-hitting contemporary commentary. The central characters of Dionysus and Xanthias have been called the original double act, and they do function in that way in many respects. We could also see the play as the origin of the buddy movie or the road movie. The play ends with what we would now call a poetry slam, in which Aeschylus and Euripides try to outdo each other with their best lines. Many are quoted from works that we no longer have, so it's difficult to judge the impact that they would have had on the audience. It certainly doesn't feel like a dramatic ending to us, and the bickering and argument between the two great poets seems like a rather sad and bitter ending to the Athenian Golden Age. Perhaps the intention was for their contest to point out the futility of bitter argument, and that what was needed was a bit of forgiveness and a clear head unencumbered with nostalgia to choose the best leaders for the future. But the message of the play is at best uncertain in our eyes, at least. Aeschylus is honoured as the Grand Master of Tragedy. He's been dead for about 50 years at this point, and still clearly very respected. His arguments are rooted in the importance of tradition and of the martial, which he would say were the greater values of tragedy, and which therefore used appropriately grand and heightened language. He also openly criticises Euripides, laying part of the blame of the decline of Athens at his feet. His plays, which feature such degenerate activities in Aeschylus's eyes as incest and childbirth inside the temples, have educated people in the wrong way to live. He says explicitly, "Because of him our city here is crammed with apes who would cheat our people." Euripides favours simple language that means all citizens can understand the meaning and the purpose of tragedy, which in turn provokes them to question the status quo. This is democracy in action. The fact that Dionysus cannot decide between the two views has several interpretations, but it's likely that Aristophanes saw some danger in coming down too firmly on one side or the other. Although his plays made political points, he survived in Athens in a very difficult time, suggesting that outside of the theatre, he managed to remain non-political or was extremely clever at picking his path around the politicians as they came and went. The deliberations by the poets lead to Dionysus posing a direct question to them about Alcibiades, a general and statesman who played a significant role in the later part of the Peloponnesian War. He would have been unknown to Aeschylus, but a younger contemporary of Euripides. Both poets give cryptic answers, and it's difficult to say if the play is pro or anti-Alcibiades, which of course might have been entirely intentional by Aristophanes if he wanted simply to spark the debate and perhaps keep himself safe. As far as the conduct of the war goes, Euripides seems to be in favour of a change of tactics if those currently being employed do not benefit the city, whereas Aeschylus seems to favour a return to the military policies of Pericles, the early and successful leader of the war effort. Whatever the answer for the play, and whether that refers to the war, to the city, to theatrical tragedy, or to Aristophanes' view on Aeschylus and Euripides in particular, the seemingly arbitrary nature of the judgments of Dionysus remains unsatisfying. More happily, the play is concerned with theatre itself, poetry and theatricality. The idea that a poet is worthy of recovering from Hades makes a bold statement about the power and importance of plays and the theatre. It's clear from the start that Dionysus believes that recovering Euripides will save Athens from its current dire predicament. Performed in the context of a festival held to honour the gods, and with the poetry competition held within the play mirroring those held as part of the festival, Aristophanes puts theatrical art right at the centre of discussions about how Athenians should behave and praise the gods and plead with them. The play is also concerned with the crossing of boundaries. Boundaries between life and death, obviously, but also between what is mortal and what belongs to the gods, and within which the division between the sacred and the profane, and reality and fantasy, to which end Dionysus displays some very human failings, which, at times, produce some of the best comedic moments of the play. The fantastical journey to Hades is full of practical concerns, like describing the route, finding the right paths, looking for signposts, and the weight of the necessary baggage for such a trip, a concern for Xanthias, at least. Dionysus shows his human side and is the butt of many jokes. He cowers in fear on more than one occasion when Xanthias shows himself to be the braver of the two travellers. It's at this point, and this is an example of how low the humour could get in Greek plays, that the god loses control of his anal nerve, only to return to the stage full of pride for himself for having been able to clean himself up without assistance. The close of the play is the last and perhaps greatest crossover of a boundary, when the chorus speak directly to the audience, referencing current Athenian leaders and reminding all of us that this is not just a performance, but a communal religious act in praise of the gods. Earlier, I framed the play as a double act, but it's not a clear-cut straight man, funny man act. Dionysus and Xanthias switch between these roles quite freely throughout. Xanthias is clever and good-natured when not being set upon by his master, whose faults he's quick to point out. The fact he has avoided military service is mentioned more than once, so there's an air of cowardice about him, and although he is more fundamentally honest than many slave characters who followed in the theatre, clearly he is a prototype for the cunning slave character that was to become such a feature of later Greek comedy and then Roman comedy. In this play, his master, although sometimes shown as a fool and a coward, is a very mild version of the god. As the god of theatre and wine, ritual pleasure and sacred ecstasy, his portrayal could go more or less in any direction. Think of the havoc caused by the same god who inspires madness and death in the Bacchae. Compared with him, this version of Dionysus is very mild-mannered indeed. Heracles and Xanthias show no fear of him, with Heracles treating him as a bit of a joke, almost contemptuously. But as the god of theatre, he is the right judge for the competition. He quotes freely from canonical works and speaks with knowledge and authority about them. Most importantly, his intentions are good. His aim in returning Euripides from Hades is to return Athens to its golden age and save the city. And I can't leave this short analysis without mention of the frogs of the chorus. In fact, they only have one chant as Dionysus and the ferryman row across the lake into Hades, and the chorus spend more time later in the play as the Eleusinian initiates. But perhaps that wasn't quite such a catchy title, And the melancholy of the frog chorus certainly catches the mood of the play's serious side. The interpretation of the frog's croaky call, represented in the translated Greek as brekekekex koax koax, has become iconic in theatre and literature, turning up in works as diverse as Finnegan's Wake, Stephen Sondheim's 1974 musical adaptation of the play, and in Aldous Huxley and Gilbert and Sullivan too. And what does a modern interpretation of the play look like? Spy Monkey cleverly wove their own story into that of the play. They used to be a quartet, but through departures to better places, as they put it, one death and one better offer in Las Vegas, they are now a double act. So the play called to them. In this production, all other parts are played by one other actress, who wore a Heracles nude bodysuit with real verve. Spy Monkey's style is physical comedy, and there was plenty of that, but also verbal sparring and some very meta-theatrical jokes, with, at one point, Dionysus and Xanthias getting caught in a scene between the scenes, playing their real-life selves, preparing for the challenge of the play. There were plenty of verbal gags too, with Xanthias riffing on a memorable string of donkey-ass jokes, and even slipping into the Euripides-Eumenides joke to a collective groan from the audience. And if you don't know exactly what that one is, just look up Euripides-Eumenides on the internet. The frog chorus were unmissable in bright green capes, and there was plenty of use of other monster costumes, and a manually propelled revolve stage, which was effectively used to give the sense of travel. Understandably, the Athenian politics and the awkward poetry slam ending are acknowledged and then sidestepped. In this case, the ending employed a giant puppet frog. At times it was perhaps a little too madcap and lost its way a bit, but once again, it was proved that Greek comedy, when suitably adapted for our time, can be very funny. Perhaps of all the Aristophanes comedies, with the exception of the timeless Lysistrata, The Frogs is the most adaptable to the modern stage, because it is the most theatrical and fantastical. Comic political commentary has to be brought up to date or avoided, and some of the questions it poses are not so easily translatable, as is, for example, the Battle of the Sexes played out in Lysistrata. But presented with adaptations to a knowledgeable theatre audience, we can find much to enjoy. Next time it's back to Shakespeare, with the promised overview of the chronology of his life and plays. In the meantime, please join the Facebook page or group, or find the podcast on Instagram or X, just to keep up to date with new episodes and other theatre-related stuff. If you do feel able to help out with the costs of running the podcast, then please head over to Patreon, where you will find additional content for a small monthly fee or a one-off donation. You can find all the details of ways to support the podcast at the website, which is www.thehistoryofeuropeantheatre.com. I look forward to your company next time, but if you do have any comments or concerns in the meantime, you can contact me by email at thoetp@gmail.com or via X @thoetp.